We're going to go back to 2 Samuel and keep going. You know, we've had a few weeks with the celebration of the birth of Jesus, and last week was about what are we resolute about? What are we going to be resolute about? And I was really encouraged and humbled and challenged by the boys on Thursday night, because there was men who were being resolute and were committed to being resolute about things, and I was challenged by that. I was encouraged by that. That was a sweet thing, and I think it's a process that we ought to be engaged in. You know, it was one of the end results. We get together on Thursday nights, the men get together, and if you're not there, you're probably not a man, but I'm just kidding. So, but actually, but maybe not, but I am. So I'll be quiet about that. But anyway, Thursday nights are about, iron sharpening iron, men being there to do it. And that's something that's been going on. I would consider it to be a foundation of this body. But one of the challenges at the end was that, you know, in that, what do we resolve to do for this year? And all of us, you know, I think all of us would probably say, gosh, you know, which one of these do I pick? You know, I mean, there's a lot of things to be resolute about that should change. You know, how can I just narrow it down to one thing that needs to be a focus of my life? There's so many things that lacking doing it. It was sweet, because one of the end games at about midnight or so was, you know, we should be intimate with each other and intimately involved in each other's lives and led by the Spirit of God to be able to have input in each other's lives. You know, to be able to say, you know, you need to start wearing different color shirts or whatever. You know, that we obviously that wouldn't be one of them, but that we should be familiar with each other's lives and families, that we know, you know, the direction that we could all take to be disciplined, to be used more effectively for the kingdom. And that was a sweet thing too. So I look forward to the next few weeks and being about that, coming up with what we are going to be resolute about this year. Not let anything get in the way. 2 Samuel chapter 13 is one that I've voiced, that I've been avoiding and haven't wanted to do, and for a month or a few weeks now. And struggle with it. It's one of the chapters in the Bible that makes me the angriest. You know, there's a lot of things, and there's a lot of Old Testament and New Testament that leads by example and gives us images of the right way to do it. And I would say this is one that gives us the wrong way to do it. But it's put there by God for the purpose of directing us as men and women and what it should look like. And the more that I went about it, when it was finally time for me to get back after it, God began to open my eyes to a bunch of stuff, and I went, oh man, now how am I going to do this on a Sunday morning? So, because there's a bunch here. I'm going to go ahead and read through this. How many of you have read 2 Samuel 13? So you're familiar with what's there recently? So I'm sure you have in the past. There's a side of it that's a very ugly story, but there's a side of it that God put it there purposely to instruct us about, you know, the wages of sin is death. And this is what it looks like. And you have a man after God's own heart in David. You know, one of the only man called that by God directly in the Bible. A man who is used powerfully and mightily by God. A man who understood the character and nature of God and served the true and living God. That allowed sin to come into his life. And we're, you know, from this point out in the book, we will see the devastating results of that. You know, and it should be an absolute challenge to us. It's not that he turned away from God in his older life. It's not that he that didn't have a relationship with God in his older life. But there's the principle in the Bible is you reap what you sow, and the wages of sin is death. And Jesus died for forgiveness so that we could be right with God, so that we didn't, our lives could be set free from the bondage of sin, from the curse of guilt and shame, and we could live in a powerful, effective life with God. But, you know, there's a misconception that sin doesn't have effect in the result of that. And David's life shows that. David's life shows as he began to get pounded. I would contend there's a couple things. One is his obvious lack of purity. You know, being in a place where we read prior to this, the story of Bathsheba and David not being where he was supposed to be, leading his men as God had called him to. You know, the truth that we should be doing what God calls us to do. And if we're not doing what God calls us to do, whether procrastinating or dragging or being undisciplined or whatever it looks like, we're in danger. And David got his fanny kicked. And obviously the fallout of that was severe and is severe. It's also pretty obvious in this chapter that David's sin of polygamy is pounding on him. Again, we've talked about that some. Polygamy culturally was not wrong. You know, David wasn't doing anything culturally that was wrong, even within the Hebrew culture. Kings always had more than one wife, you know. And, you know, that God, you know, again, it's a big deal, but you won't find a verse in the Bible, you know, that says don't be a polygamist. You know, that's a pretty big statement, you know. If I was a polygamist, obviously, right now, what would you get? You guys wouldn't be here, would you? Right? You think, you either? You know, because we would see it as absolutely wrong doing it. You know, there was a lot of men who were polygamists in the Bible. God doesn't ever seem to directly call them out on it. Is it God's heart? Absolutely not. Is the way God designed it? Absolutely not. God designed the two to become one flesh. And yet, culturally, it was accepted. You know, it's an amazing thing. We accept divorce in our culture, but we certainly don't accept, even within the church, but we don't accept polygamy. God hates divorce and comes down against divorce, speaks out directly against divorce doing it. Both of them are wrong in doing it. So, we see the effects, throughout the Bible, we see the effects of polygamy on people's lives. You know, whether it was Abraham or whoever, you know, doing it, that there was just negative pounding effects of polygamy. And this chapter reflects that also, pretty severely and pretty directly. So let's pray. God, these people are here because they want to be taught by you, not by me. So we need you to override my stumbling and bumbling and speak to their hearts. There's some truths here that we need to be resolute about as men and women. There's some truths about you and your law, what you say is right and wrong, what righteousness looks like, obedience to you, disobedience to you, that we all should be challenged by. So God, I ask you to please soften our hearts to hear your word and hear your truth. I don't know how. I thank you for Brent being here today and purposing to fellowship with believers. I ask that you would cause him to be inspired in the midst of this town and valley to lead a men's group next weekend up in a yurt up in Galena area. God, I ask that you begin the process in him now to conform, to hear your word, to hear your truth, to to be taught by you to speak what you want him to speak. And how you want him to lead and what you want to do to cause those men to be men that are in pursuit of you. I ask that you would continue to hold Rain Jen in your hands, in your arms, as they go through a time of grieving and trying to figure out and deal with the whole issue of death. And I thank you. In spite of the roughness and the ugliness of it, I know that all of us, the rest of us in this room, are blessed to be able to be with them here. And I thank you for that. I ask you to continue to protect them in the weeks and months to come as they go through the grieving process. And God, I ask you to guard them, that this would be something that draws them closer to you. So teach us, God. Teach us from your word. Soften our hearts. Kick us in the fanny, whatever it takes to hear your truth and to be moved and changed by us. Don't let us walk away and erase it as it goes out the door. So be God in our lives and be the teacher. You are the teacher. You're the only teacher. In the name of Jesus, amen. So here we are. The end, there's a side of me that 12 was tough enough. At the end of 12, David went, Joab was fighting against Rahab, the sons of Ammon, and captured the royal city. David went there. They went there and they basically took control of it, subdued the enemies in doing it. There's a verse in verse 31 I just want to touch on before we hit 13. It says, and he brought out the people who were in it. And he set them under saws, sharp iron instruments, iron axes, and made them pass through the brick kiln. Really? I mean, the implication of first reading would mean that's he tortured them to death, right? Okay. Does anybody have a New International Version here? Not my favorite, but, there's a side of it that it's a better rendition of it. What it means is he put them basically in slavery to do these things. He put them under the workforce. Guys were Bedouins, farmers, Bedouin, sheep herders, goat herders, whatever, wandered around and were not used to doing these things. So I think the more correct interpretation, as best that I can find out, was that he subjected them to, this is going to be your life now. You're going to make bricks, you're going to have pickaxes, and you're going to be about doing these things. I don't think that this is implying, I'm confident at this point, that it's not implying that he tortured him to death. Try to find ways to do that. So, David, I can't say that David wasn't going through some rough times of rehabbing after being rebellious to God for a period of time in his life, but I don't think it was quite this degenerate that he was doing it. Anyway, I think the better interpretation, when you look at the words and what happens, more correct understanding would be that he put them, subjected them to this, to hard labor, basically. So, then David and all the people returned to Jerusalem. So here we are in 13. Now, let me read through it quickly, if you can follow or listen or however you learn best. I'll go back and look at it. Now it was after that Absalom, the son of David, had a beautiful sister whose name was Tamar. And Ammon, the son of David, loved her. And Ammon was so frustrated because of his sister Tamar that he made himself ill, for she was a virgin, and it seemed hard for Ammon to do anything to her. But Ammon had a friend whose name was Jonadab, the son of Shimeah, David's brother, so his cousin. He had that bad little cousin guy, that Jonadab was a very shrewd man. And he said to him, "O son of the king, why are you so depressed morning after morning? Will you not tell me?" Then Ammon said to him, "I am in love with Tamar, the sister of my brother Absalom." I would contend that word love is used like we use it in this culture, distinct from how the Bible uses it. But I am in love with Tamar, the sister of my brother Absalom. Jonadab then said to him, "Lie down on your bed and pretend you are ill. when your father comes to see you, say to him, please let my sister Tamar come and give me some food to eat, and let her prepare the food in my sight that I may see it and I may eat it from her hand. So Ammon lay down and pretended to be ill. When the king came to see him, Ammon said to the king, please let my sister Tamar come and make a couple of cakes in my sight that I may eat from her hand. Then David sent to the house of Tamar, saying, go now to your brother Ammon's house and prepare food for him. So Tamar went to her brother Ammon's house, and he was lying down, and she took dough, kneaded it, and made cakes in his sight, and baked the cakes. And she took the pan and dished them out before him, but he refused to eat. And Ammon said, have everyone go out from me. So everyone went out from him. Remember, Ammon is David's oldest son, probably the heir to be king. That's his firstborn son, basically, in Hebrew. And it infers that was his firstborn son. So this is a pretty powerful man. The king's son is pretty powerful. Again, equate it to, we don't equate that. We don't understand that, what that looks like to be a king and what it looks to have a monarch who held absolute power. And this is his son and probably the one in line for his kingdom. But he sent everyone out from him, and he probably had royal guards, that were there. Plus his friend that took care of him. He was a king's son. And she took a pan. So Tamar went, then Ammon said to Tamar, bring the food into the bedroom that I may eat from your hand. So Tamar took the cakes which she had made and brought them into the bedroom to her brother Ammon. When she brought them in to eat, he took hold of her and said to her, come, lie with me, my sister. But she answered him, no, my brother, do not violate me, for such a thing is not done in Israel, and do not do this disgraceful thing. As for me, where could I get rid of my reproach? And as for you, you will be like one of the fools in Israel. Now therefore, please speak to the king, and he will not withhold me from you. However, he would not listen to her, since he was stronger than she. He violated her, and he lay with her. Then Ammon hated her with a very great hatred. Wasn't really in love, was he? For the hatred with which he hated her was greater than the love with which he had loved her. And Ammon said to her, get up, go away. But she said to him, no, because this wrong is in sending me away is greater than the other that you have done to me. But he would not listen to her. Then he called his young man who attended him and said, now throw this woman out of my presence, and lock the door behind her. Now she had on a long-sleeved garment. For in this manner the virgin daughters of the king dressed themselves in robes. Then his attendant took her out and locked the door behind her. And Tamar put ashes on her head and tore her long-sleeved garment which was with her. And she put her hand on her head and went away, crying aloud as she went. Then Absalom, her brother, said to her, has Ammon your brother been with you? But now keep silent, my sister. He is your brother. Do not take this matter to heart. So Tamar remained and was desolate in her brother's household. Now when King David heard all these matters, he was very angry. But Absalom did not speak to Ammon, either good or bad, for Absalom hated Ammon because he had violated his sister Tamar. Now it came about after 2 full years that Absalom had sheep shearers in Baal-Hazor, which is near Ephraim, and Absalom invited all the king's sons. And Absalom came to the king and said, behold now, your servant has sheep shearers. Remember parties before? Sheep shearing parties were a big celebration. Remember we read about that with Nabal? Remember once when David was running from Saul and Nabal was having a great big sheep shearing and it was a huge party doing it and things didn't go so well for Nabal in the process. But this was a major time of celebration, shearing the sheep. So he invited he came to the king and said, behold, let your servant has sheep shears. Please let the king and his servants go with your servant. But the king said to Absalom, no, my son, we shall not go, lest we be burdensome to you. Although he urged him, he would not go, but blessed him. Then Absalom said, if not, please let my brother Ammon go with us. And the king said to him, why should he go with you? But when Absalom urged him, he let Ammon and all the king's sons go with him. And Absalom commanded his servants, saying, see now, when Ammon's heart is merry with wine, and when I say to you, strike Ammon, then put him to death. Do not fear, have I not commanded you? Be courageous and be valiant. And the servants of Absalom did to Amnon just as Absalom had commanded. Then all the king's son arose, and each mounted his mule and fled. Now it was while they were on the way that the report came to David saying, Absalom has struck down all the king's sons, and not one of them is left. Then the king arose, tore his clothes, and lay on the ground, and all the servants were standing by him with clothes torn. And Jonadab, oh, here's this good friend, huh? Excuse me. The guy that had told him, you know, here, now he's the king's buddy, you know, this would be the king's nephew, you know, and he was the cousin of Ammon that told him to do what he did and lie with his sister, but now he's his buddy. Now Jonadab, the son of Shimei, David's brother, responded, "Do not let my lords suppose that they have put to death all the young men, the king's sons, for Ammon alone is dead. Because by the intent of Absalom, this has been determined since the day that he violated his sister Tamar. Now therefore, do not let my lord the king take the report to heart, namely, all the king's sons are dead, for only Ammon is dead." Now Absalom had fled, and the young man who was the watchman raised his eyes and looked, and behold, many of the people were coming from the road behind him by the side of the mountain. And Jonadab said to them, to the king, "Behold, the king's sons have come, according to the servant's word." So it happened. And it came about, as soon as he had finished speaking, that behold, the king's sons came and lifted their voices and wept. And also the king and all his servants wept very bitterly. Now Absalom fled and went to Talmai, the son of Almahud, the king of Geshur. And David mourned for his sons every day, for his son every day. So Absalom had fled and gone to Geshur and was there 3 years. And the heart of the king, David, longed to go out to Absalom, for he was comforted concerning Ammon since he was dead. What a mess. Right? I mean, a brother raped his sister, and here we are. There's some pretty important, profound lessons to be learned here. You know, one, it's always important to try to, on some level, understand the culture and also understand what God's previous commandments. God, in Leviticus, God had told him that this was not to be a marriage, that Tamar and Ammon should not have been married. They were up from the same father. And it makes it clear they were not to be married. Now, culturally, there was nothing wrong with it again. You know, the Jewish, even at the time, would have found it to be okay that he could have married Tamar. Again, there's a few things here going on. David, remember in the Psalms, he talks about loving God's law and knew the law and had read the law and was determined by God's heart in the law, had seemed to have forgotten it, you know. There's also the inference here when it says that in verse 29, it says the king and all his sons rose and each mounted his mule and fled. That's the first mention of a mule. Leviticus says to not interbreed. You know, says that there shouldn't have been mules. You know, that there was a donkey and a horse went together. Horses they used primarily for pulling chariots. Donkeys tend to be what they rode around on. I don't know why they did this, man. I'd have chose the horse and forget the donkey, but here we are. But how far they had gone away from the law and the specifics of the law, it appears they've gone a ways away, because David didn't act on it too. But there's a few things that I hope in some ways are by way of reminder to you men. I think that it's important to look at this and see some pretty amazing devastation and damage, because this starts a process that's just ugly and tragic, you know, in the lives of David, you know, and as a father, David's heart's about to remain broken for the rest of his life in a lot of ways because of the devastation that happened. And why? Why did this happen and what went on? There's a few things I want to look at here, and hit on, because they're very pertinent and they apply to us here. You know, there's a side of it that it's easy to look at this guy Ammon and go, how perverted. You know, I mean, if it doesn't strike something in all of you men to want to kill the guy, then something's probably wrong with you, right? I mean, he raped his sister. You know, he took advantage and raped his sister. And that should inspire anger, right? That should inspire an anger that Deuteronomy is pretty clear. If David was following the law, I don't know exactly what happened in this story because it's a little tough to tell. I mean, there's part of it that we have to understand that even though Tamar, who he says was beautiful, about Absalom, it said that he was perfect from the top of his head to the end of his feet. There was no imperfection in him. Absalom was obviously a good looking, kind of like Yanni's kids, you know, or something, you know, these perfect, beautiful little kids, you know, doing it. But Absalom was an adult that was just a beautiful, I wouldn't say beautiful man, handsome man. There was no imperfection in him. And his sister Tamar was, it says, a beautiful woman, right? So this response of Ammon, David's oldest son, to Tamar, it was probably a division. You know, it says that he sent for her house. There was probably little time that he spent. It wasn't like we think of. They didn't live in the same homes. They probably lived somehow with their own mothers, okay, and were raised with their own mothers individually in the compound or whatever that looked like on it. Culturally, historically, there was a good chance that the girls, the sisters, as they got older, stayed on one side of the palace and the men stayed on the other side of the palace, and there was probably little personal contact, you know, as far as brother, sister, being best buddies or something like that. But, you know, the Ammon, obviously, being, I would contend, the king's eldest son, having the privileges of a king. I don't know what he did or what he didn't do, but obviously he had lost his mind, right? We need to, you know, there's so many things that are pertinent that come to mind here. You know, you're in the process of reading James. You know, and we think about, because it's so pertinent what happens in us as men. And we've talked about sexual purity a lot in what God calls us to. And the standard today is not lower. The standard is higher. Last week we read 1 Peter, right? What did 1 Peter say? Let me just read it again. There's, excuse me. Hang on here because I've got about 15 places I want to go here, and hang on while I run down it. They're not rabbit trails, they're God's heart on these things. But remember last week we read in 2 Peter, it says, Simon Peter, a bondservant and apostle of Jesus Christ, to those who have received a faith of the same kind as ours. Understand, that's a qualification here. Okay? That this faith, the same kind of ours, meant Peter understood that Jesus was the Son of the living God, was the third part of the Trinity, that he was Lord, that he was King Jesus, and he understood that. And the faith that he had, the trust that he had in him, was based on the character and nature of the true and living God. And that's who we perceive Jesus to be, not just diminished hippie looking dude in the pictures of the church, okay? He was king, and he understood that. And the faith that Peter was talking about was a faith that believed in the lordship, the master, that Jesus was master of our lives. And that's the faith, the same kind of ours. As a result of that, he says, grace and peace be multiplied to you in the knowledge of God and the Lord Jesus Christ, seeing that his divine power, the divine power of Jesus, the power of the true and living God, has granted to us everything pertaining to life and godliness. This is the baseline that we can function from. If we are born again believers, if the Spirit of God dwells in us, then, because we have recognized the Lordship of Jesus Christ and given our lives and laid our lives down to the Lordship of Jesus Christ, and we can be born again, we can be saved, okay? It's not about having a religious understanding or a correct doctrine or theology. I don't really care about what the words come out of your mouth. Is it something that transforms what your feet do, what your boots do? Okay? Is it something that you truly believe in the Lordship of Jesus Christ? Have you been born again in that? If you have, then he has given us everything pertaining to godliness through the true knowledge of him who called us, not a false God, not a different God, but the true knowledge of the true God who called us by his own glory and excellence. For by these he has granted to us his precious and magnificent promises, in order that by them you might become partakers of the divine nature. That's not when you die. That is becoming partakers of the divine nature as a born again, a new creature, having escaped the corruption that is in the world by lust. Ammon didn't escape that, did he? Now, on the other hand, we look at that and see Ammon wasn't born again. You know, we don't have the concept in the Old Testament of being born again. Okay? We have the looking forward in appropriating the work that Jesus was going to do was absolute obedience to God, was the correct response to God, no different than it is now. Okay? Obedience to God and submission to God was true then. What did that compromise? That looked forward to the work of Jesus and the cross through sacrifice, through the killing of lambs, through the shedding of bulls and goats and lambs, and the pouring out of the blood, looking forward to the necessity of the propitiatory sacrifice of Jesus Christ for us all. So their obedience and their boots were just as important then as they are now, and ours are just as important as they are then. And what you do, what are you determined by? Are you determined by the true and living God? So they weren't born again. Did the Spirit of God? Yeah, we know the Spirit of God came and dwelt in, empowered in, moved through, filled. Remember when Samuel went to David, it said the Spirit of God came on him heavily from that day forward. So the Spirit of God did, but as Saul, remember the Spirit of God came on Saul too, but how'd that go? In his disobedience, God pulled his spirit from him. And as a result, demonic forces were allowed to control and move him, sway him. So these days, you know, I'm a believer that if we are true believers, I don't believe in that we lose that. I believe that once we truly become true children of the Most High God, and are transformed by the renewing of our minds, and are transformed in the process, and obviously all of us are in process, but are empowered by the Spirit of God, we can be set free. Why is this important? Because it's essential that we escape the corruption that is in this world by lust. Okay? You look at this guy Ammon, and this is no different. We can judge him hard. But let's look at what that looks like in modern day. What did Jesus say about that? You know, we can probably, I would assume, and I would certainly hope that the majority of us in this room could stand on some grounds and haven't raped my sister, okay? I would hope, okay? Although, the truth of it is that one out of three girls will be sexually molested by the time they're 18. And most of that is by a family member or somebody close. One out of between four and five boys will be sexually molested. And most of it's by somebody close. So this is today a current thing. It always has been a current thing. Perversion and all the ramifications that happen from it. And there's reasons beyond the enemy wanting to inflict that tragic perversion on a child, and it isn't just to devastate them directly from it. What it really is to determine their character for a lifelong, and most people don't get past it. Most people don't get past a lack of trust in God, in a father. Most people don't get past the survival instincts that are created. Most people don't get past one of the greatest tragedies that I see in childhood, molestation of whatever form, is that you develop a victim complex. And a victim complex, understandable. Is a child a victim? Absolutely. An innocent victim? Probably in most cases, yes. An innocent victim on that deal. But the powerful effect it has, that it's not my fault, which I don't know that a child has any hope but to think this is not my fault when he's being molested by somebody who he should be able to trust and take care of him. It is not your fault, right? The weakness in that is the enemy's purpose in that is to create that character and that nature in you that the rest of your life you're going to say it's not my fault. And there comes a point in all of our lives where we have to go, it is my fault. It is my fault. My sin is my fault. I need God to die for my sin because I have purposely spit in the face of the Most High God. And I have to take accountability and responsibility for that. Very difficult to do if that in that process the enemy has worked his victim character in you. Because you've what's happening to you is not your fault. And I would consider all of us need to look at that in our lives if that is the case, because that will keep you from having a relationship with the true and living God. Because the essential baseline is taking ownership of our sin and our rebellion towards God. If we do not know that, we do not need Jesus. Okay? If it's not my fault, I don't need Jesus. And if I don't need Jesus and recognize my desperate need for Jesus, you're not going to have a right relationship with God. You are not going to know forgiveness and have a right relationship with God. So the purpose of abuse, I believe, goes way beyond just tormenting that child and abusing that child, which is terrible. But it happens. But it happens even beyond that. And I guess where you need to be careful, because I know over the last couple months of reading this and having the story in the forefront of my mind and the wretchedness of it is this, in spite of what we would all like to think and how angry we get and how much we would like to take this boy Ammon and shoot him and beat him. And I I'll state right here, I'm not sure that Absalom did the wrong thing necessarily. I mean, that's a big statement, okay, in doing it. When you look at Deuteronomy and look at what God said about it, he was to be put to death, okay? God's heart in that deal was he's to be put to death. Let me go to Deuteronomy a minute, because I think that it's Deuteronomy chapter 22. That's a pretty impactful deal. But the truth of it is that all of us have acted in a way that was deserving of that death. I can guarantee there's not a man in here, okay, who has not committed adultery in his mind. And we say, oh, but that's not the same thing. Oh, really? Is that what Jesus said? That's not what Jesus said. Jesus made it pretty clear. I'll read that first, because Jesus made it real clear. It says, I don't know, where am I? What's that? 22, yeah, that's where you'll be in. 22:22 is actually where we're reading Deuteronomy. Again, please hang with me because I'm running here. Matthew chapter 5, okay? And again, this is a familiar passage to those of us on Thursday night. But take it to heart, because you know the way you feel about Ammon, and if you don't, you should, okay? For what he did. But look what it says. You've heard it said, because this is speaking to the religious Pharisees, as we all have a propensity to become. You have heard that it was said, you shall not commit adultery. Okay? You shall not act out in your sexual perversion. Is that correct? Absolutely, that's correct. But do you stand righteously on the fact that I haven't? But I say to you, this is Jesus saying to you, this is Jesus saying to us, to every one of us, men and women, that everyone who looks on a woman, or a man for that matter, to lust for her, has committed adultery with her already in his heart. And, was Jesus exaggerating? Or did he mean what he said? He meant what he said. But that seems impossible. To think lustfully. What is lust? Lust means an imbalance, an overwhelming, consuming desire for. Okay? And if you have a desire, a sexual desire, for any woman besides your wife, and if you're not married, for any woman, that's lust. That's sexual lust. And Jesus says, if you have any desire, if you allow that to go on, which all of us have, by the way, okay? That's not an excuse. That's not an acceptable thing. Jesus says, you've committed adultery with her already in heart. You know how he feels about this? And this is This is made ethereal and distant, and don't read it, okay? The world says, and we're adults in here, it doesn't matter, the world says God doesn't ever talk about masturbation, right? It doesn't talk about lust. Really? Let's read these next verses. It says, and if your right eye makes you stumble, tear it out. That's looking, that's pornography, that's anything that causes your mind to go to a sexual place with any woman besides your wife. Period. Well, that's awful harsh. Did we not just read 1 Peter? And it says, is it equipped us with everything necessary for godliness? Can we be set free from that? Yes, we can be set free from that. We can know purity. We can be set free from that. It seems impossible because we've lived our lives in bondage to it. We look around us. The world and our society is consumed by it. God calls us to a different place. God calls us to holiness. Okay? In fact, at the end of this chapter, in chapter 5 of Matthew, with Jesus teaching, Jesus himself, not somebody extrapolating what he said, Jesus himself, therefore, you are to be perfect as your heavenly Father is perfect. Oh, wait a minute. He's okay with my sin. No, he's not okay with our sin. Okay? God is not okay with our sin. If your right eye causes you to stumble, tear it out. Throw it from you. For it is better for you that one of the parts of your body perish than for your whole body to be thrown into hell. That's pretty strong language. Do you think that God says, fine with me lusting after his daughters? Let me tell you what, he thinks differently about it. He thinks differently about it. Okay? Oh, and if your right hand makes you stumble, cut it off and throw it from you. For it is better for you that one of the parts of your body perish than for your whole body to go into hell. I don't think he was being metaphoric. Okay? I don't think that he was just being extreme. Oh, Jesus lost his mind. Say such things. This is Jesus. Do we believe him? Do we take him as Lord and King? Do we believe what he said? And we have been empowered to live that way. Okay? We can be set free. Okay? And the problem is, if we are not, what will happen? You're in James. Levi, you know what this is. And it's a sweet passage that talks about us. Because all of us, as men and women, have said, well, we're just overwhelmed by it. It's just the way we are. We can't help it. We're just consumed by this. Really. Blessed is the man who perseveres under trial. For once he has been approved, he will receive the crown of life, which the Lord has promised to those who love him. Let no man say when he is tempted, I am being tempted by God. Or in other words, I cannot help this. Or this is the way God made me. Right? That's a pretty big statement for somebody who calls himself a Christian to make, huh? I can't help it. God made me this way, right? Do not say that I am being tempted of God. For God cannot be tempted by evil, and he himself does not tempt anyone. But each one is tempted when he is carried away and enticed by his own lust. How do you get down that road that seems out of control? I can't help myself. This is just the way I am. How do we do that? When we give in to it, each one is tempted when he is carried away and enticed by his own lust. We don't even need demonic to help us with that. Right? We are born that way. We are born selfishly. We are born to self-satisfy. We are born in rebellion to the Most High God and to what he says. And we very easily head down in our own flesh. We head down a road which is self-gratification and self-satisfying. Opposite of what he meant sexuality to be. He meant sexuality to be an absolute welding force between you and your wife. That's what he meant it to be. It wasn't your toy to play with. It was meant to be a welding force between you and your wife. Now, I understand. That's really a pain in the fanny sometimes, right? Because God created this sexuality and he sticks the sex drive between us. And you're frustrated and you want to have sex, but I don't like my wife very much. We're kind of in a wreck. That would never be true. Yes, it is true at times, okay? And I don't want to make things right, or you're in a fight, or things aren't real well, okay? Uh-oh, now I got to work. It would be a lot easier to self-gratify, right? I mean, you grow up your whole life learning how to do that. Okay? No. God meant it to be, get your butt over and make things right so your wife wants to have sex with you. So your wife wants to have an intimate relationship and wants to be intimate with you on doing that. That takes a lot of work at times. But that's how God intended it to be. Instead, what do? We give in to these thoughts. We give in to these fantasies that we have in our mind. You know, the issue with masturbation is that it does not happen outside of lust. Okay? It puts you in an incredibly... So what is the object of your lust? Okay? Where does that go? That's really the issue. It's committing adultery in your mind. Or committing fornication in your mind. Committing sexual perversion in your mind. Okay? But each one is tempted when he is carried away and enticed by his own lust. He lets it go. Then when lust has conceived, it gives birth to sin. And when sin is accomplished, it brings forth death. Do not be deceived, my beloved brethren. Okay? Do not be deceived. So, here we are, Ammon. That kind of describes him, doesn't it? Was it love? The word is love that they use in the Old Testament. Was it love that he was consumed with over Tamar? By the way he acted, obviously not. By the way, it was lust. What? It was eros. That's a Greek word. It wasn't quite going on in Hebrew at the time. But it was definitely it is actually quite similar to the word that we as Americans use at love. That I really, really, really like her. That I really, really, really feel strongly. Okay? Which has nothing to do with agape and what we're commanded to do. Agape is to regard one as more important than yourself. Agape is to submit to the needs of that person. Agape is to act selflessly towards another person. That's what agape love is. That is obviously not what was moving and motivating him. Okay? I would contend that this is the love that we marry under in our culture. Most marriages are based in this guy. I really love her. I'm really infatuated with her. And you know, this kind of love, infatuation, we tend to knock it off and say, oh, that's kids, that's puppy love or something like that. 99% of marriages get married based on the fact I'm infatuated, okay? It's an incredibly powerful elixir that God gave us, okay? God desires that we are infatuated with Him, okay? And God desires that I'm infatuated with my wife. But let me tell you what. That takes a lot of work, okay? That doesn't happen just because you're in love or the perfect person. There is no perfect person, by the way. In the infatuation that motivated you to do the dishes and bring flowers and be selfless and act selfless and all these things was based in selfishness. That's what most people get married on, okay? Oh, isn't this cute? You know, look, he does everything for me. He does everything for me. And pretty soon, I don't like you that much anymore, so I don't want to do things for you, right? None of you, those of you who aren't married think that's not going to happen. Those of you who are married know it does. Okay? That's the way it is. Okay? What does it mean then? Well, we're to respond in agape love. We're not to respond to our wives based on how I feel about her or how much I like her or how infatuated I am with her. Infatuation is a wondrous thing. I am more infatuated with my wife now than I've been since I probably first saw her at 15. You know? And I was kind of stupid then, infatuated, but really stupid then. But at this point, you know, I mean, she's prettier and sexier and all kinds of good stuff, you know, doing it. And I'm not, my eyes aren't going that bad either, you know. It is a matter of perspective and work and commitment. And I will tell you more than anything what is the result of. And if I could encourage you, all of you, single or married, the greatest erotic elixir, the greatest aphrodisiac that God gave us is holiness and purity. And when that is in a relationship, that brings eroticism. That brings guilt-free nakedness. And the wonder is God created it to be in the garden before sin came. And that's what God intended it to be. Powerful. Powerful elixir. But that's holiness. It's not what the devil says. What's the devil say? Stolen water is sweet, right? That's what the devil says. You know? And anything that gets that, oh my gosh, going, you know, that's a wonderful thing. And so we cheat and we live adulterous and we're rebellious to God and we do all kinds of things to try to get that sexual addiction and rush. God says holiness is the key to eroticism. And I know subjectively that is true. You know, I was lied to as a kid by everything and not told truth by the church. And you didn't talk about sex in church, right? I'm not supposed to be doing this, right? You're not supposed to talk about sex in church. This is where we talk about it, okay? God talks about it in here a lot. So we should too, okay? In the world, you're going to go out there and today you will be talked to about sex from a lie's perspective, okay? Tomorrow you will. The next day you will. Anytime we're outside of this building, we will be talked to about sexuality from a false perspective, from the enemy's perspective. We're kind of out of balance at then, okay? So that's what I'm about and willing to do. And I would say I hope I don't offend, but I don't really care if I speak truth. You know? So I hope that we are challenged to not end up like this Ammon dude, okay? This guy let it run away and look what happened. Right? Let's read Deuteronomy 22 to see what the response that God, if David was following the law. Because one of the biggest problems here, and this is the problem, this is the major problem with men being men as God has called us to be in our culture, with men being husbands, with men being fathers, with men being men as they're to be, which is the reason for most of the problems in our culture. The vast majority of problems in our culture can be real directly gone back to men not being men as God has called them to be men. Okay? And the biggest inhibitor of that is guilt and shame. Okay? Biggest inhibitor. We are emasculated in a metaphorical way. Okay? In a figurative way, by guilt and shame. Jesus knew that. That's why he says directly, I came to set you free from guilt and shame because it will control you. It will dominate you. It will determine you. And we are not to live in bondage to guilt and shame. And we can be set free from it. That's what the gospel really is. That's what the good news is. We don't much know what that looks like because we walk around in this world with men full of guilt and shame in doing it. Because they haven't known the freedom they can know in the truth of the gospel. This is what God felt about Ammon, okay? And Tamar. I don't know quite what happened. I know he was the king's son. You didn't get to question that. The king's son carried incredible authority. This isn't just somebody on the street, okay? He had guards that would probably kill at his will in doing that. Just like Absalom did, right? Absalom told his servants there to kill Ammon, right? And what did they do? Killed Ammon. Okay? He says, I, the king's son, have told you to do this, and with that authority, you're clear. Okay? Because I've told you to do this. This is what God says about it. In Deuteronomy 22, this obviously doesn't work with the ethic of the 60s. Okay? Or anything from that. Okay? Because that ethic has... You know, if you can't be with the one you love, love the one you're with, right? I mean, that's what it says. You know, that's the movement that, you know, oh, as long as it's love, right? I mean, as long as it's love, then that's all that matters. This is what God says in verse 22. If a man is found lying with a married woman, this is Moses. But remember, he went up on the mountain and heard directly from God on this deal. So, this is God's heart. This is what God feels about sexual immorality. If a man is found lying with a married woman, then both of them shall die. The man who lay with the woman and the woman. Thus she will purge the evil from Israel. If there is a girl who is a virgin engaged to a man, and another man finds her in the city and lies with her, then you shall bring them both out to the gate of that city, and you shall stone them to death. The girl, because she did not cry out in the city. Because the implication is, if you're in the city, somebody could have heard you. Okay? Because she did not cry out in the city. And the man, because he has violated his neighbor's wife. Now understand something, okay? It doesn't say she's married. But if it is not your wife, it is someone else's wife. Okay? whether she knows it now or not, you know. There's a few beautiful women in here that are waiting to know who that boy is who's going to be your husband, right, in doing it. And you're not wife yet, but you were created to be that. And it's the direction that you're heading in doing it. And you are someone else's wife, right? And that, and I, if it is not your wife, it is someone else's wife, okay? And that's the purpose that he's making here. But, because he has violated his neighbor's wife, thus you shall purge the evil from among you. But if in the field a man finds a girl who is engaged, and the man forces her and lies with her, then only the man who lies with her shall die. But if, and I'll go back there, he's talking about someone who is engaged, okay? Now, the understanding here, and we've talked about this, is it, Jesus refers to it when he talks about divorce. And Joseph did it with Mary, right? That there was this, you know, Joseph was engaged to Mary, but the only way to break that was a certificate of divorce, right? God called that engagement period, that betrothal period, as binding, absolutely binding. And the only way out of that binding relationship was if that woman was unfaithful during that betrothal period. And he said, that's the only reason, if they are unfaithful during that betrothal period, on doing it. So, we're talking about a woman who is engaged. Obviously, that was somebody's wife, even though she was a virgin, because she is not, God has a different perception. It ain't to be test-driven before you get married, okay? God has a different view of that, okay? Virginity is something that we should honor and esteem as those who believe in the true and living God and follow this Bible. It is something that we need to implement into our children, that this is this is good. This is not stupid or backwards or, you know, ancient belief. They should honor and esteem and look forward and cherish their virginity. And look forward to this magical moment of virginity coming together in marriage and becoming one flesh. And they will know that not by our culture, right? Because our culture will not tell them that. How will they know that? By us. And silence on the topic will produce wrong understanding. Okay? They need to understand the value and the greatness of virginity. Because we are a culture that does not understand that and does not see that. Okay? There is tremendous value. Why? Because there is no baggage. There is not guilt and shame. The two becoming one flesh. There is tremendous power in virginity. Okay? We see it few times in this culture, but it should be something that you directly fight for. And that doesn't mean by rules and regulations. That means by explaining the grandeur and the wonder and the majesty of purity and holiness and virginity coming together in marriage. That it is much better to take the Corvette, supercharged Corvette, for a ride, okay? Or whatever one would go really fast. It is much better to not steal the keys and go out on a dirt road and run it into a tree, right? Because that's what sex before marriage is. It's much better to have it sitting in the car going, oh my gosh, when I turn 16, baby, I get the keys. And I can go, yeah! You know, and you get 16, your dad sends you to some driving school, you know, you kind of got it dialed, so you're ready to go, and you can hop in that car and go for a ride in an untouched, untrashed, unmolested car. If a kid was told that, would he be willing to wait? Yeah. Versus, I'm gonna steal the keys and go for a spin on the back road and trash this thing. Jump, maybe see if it'll jump some, you know, or something on doing it, you know, right? He's willing to wait in such an instance, okay? And it's a wondrous thing he looks forward to. It is no different for our sons and our daughters, okay? And our daughters should hear no other lies from the stinking selfish men that are in their lives. And our sons should act no other way towards the women that God allows in their lives. That this is a precious, wondrous thing. This isn't because sex and marriage is no fun, so I better get it out of my system. I mean, there is a propagated statement in our culture that says, let's send our kids to college so they can get all the wildness out of their system, including sexuality, so then when they have to settle down, then that's out of their system. Is there any more evil statement you could make? I mean, that's a terrible thing. to say. But we literally say that. Men to their sons. Go ahead. Go have sex. Go ahead. Participate in debauchery. Go ahead. Doing it, you know, because then you're going to have to settle down in doing that. Okay? Our kids need to learn that, man, this is a precious, precious gift that God has given us for wondrous eroticism. And that guilt-free sexuality is the most erotic sexuality you can know. And you will destroy it. Sin brings death. And you will trash it. And God created it in all its glory. Okay? Why do we let Satan promote that it's his ground? It is not his ground. It is God's ground. And the way we know it is in God's ground is through pity. We need to have our kids before, while they still think it's icky, okay? While they still think it's icky, okay? While they still think it's, you know, doing it. They need to understand this concept that the two becoming one flesh in marriage is a wondrous thing they're looking forward to. They need to hold that up. They need to hold it high. So that their fleshly lusts, so that the lies of this world do not determine them. But the truth of the living God determines them. This is how God feels about it. And why does he feel this way? Because he's a killjoy. He doesn't want you to have sex. I mean, think of all the romance of my boyfriend and I and all this thing. No! God says the reason that he is so staunch on it is because he knows how he created it. And the truth is, he created it to represent our relationship with him. And when we trash it, we do not understand a relationship with him. Becoming one is the same word that he uses in sexuality between a man and his wife and our becoming one with him. That's an intimate becoming one that he uses for that word, okay? To the degree that we misunderstand sexuality, we misunderstand the purity that we can have in our relationship with God and the intimacy that we can have, the unbroken fellowship we can have with God. Where our marriage beds are defiled, our sexuality is defiled, and our relationship with God is defiled with sin and brokenness and shame and worshiping other gods and having other gods before us. Sexuality causes tremendous damage in our minds, in our psyche, and the enemy will use that. Most marriages, unfortunately, never come free of it. Never learn that you can be set free from that in your marriage. You can clean a defiled marriage bed. And all of us have that process, I would guarantee, in our culture, the necessity of that. And it can be done. That's Jesus died for that. Okay? That we can wash the sheets and we can start off and live in purity. But much better to not have a defiled marriage bed. And we need to realize the importance of that to our children. And raise them up with that sacredness of that. You know, that exonerate the Corvette. And I don't want to diminish sexuality by calling it, I don't care what kind of, whatever, Ferrari. It doesn't even matter because nothing even compared. But they should see that Ferrari and want to drive it. And know that dad and mom go for rides in it and they're really excited about it, right? You know, but I don't get to go in that car and go for riding it till I turn 16, right? Until I go through driving school, and then he's going to throw me the keys and say, go. You know, you should look forward to that. You should see that car there and think about it. And think about the purity of it there and the wonder of it there. So that he's willing to hold it that sacred that he's not just going to go abuse it. It's to be something that he doesn't want to go steal the keys and see if he can go jump the car in the back 40. Okay? And do it. God says, he talks about the field. If one is engaged, you can't do it. It's a little bit tenuous to me. I don't know. You know why Tamar didn't scream? Why she didn't cry out? I don't know quite what happened there, and I really can't say. But we know God's heart on this. And if David was following the law, what should have happened to Ammon? Killed. Should have been killed. His own son. Right? So here we come to the main part of this that I knew I wouldn't have time. That is really important. Because to me, the most tragic part of this whole thing is, okay? Well, when King David heard all these matters, he was very angry. Right? But what did he do? What did he do? Nothing. Why didn't he do anything? I'm going to speculate a little bit. But he didn't do anything because he had guilt and shame. Because he looked at this Ammon and said, you know, I did that with Bathsheba. And committed murdered Uriah, an innocent, virtuous, valorous man. Because of my lust. What can I say? One of the greatest deterrents to us being the parents we were supposed to be is guilt and shame. It can be dealt with and needs to be dealt with. I know subjectively, personally, and all of you probably do, my parents began a pursuit of God, and I will use that story. They pretty, you know, when I was young, when I was 4 or 5, they were pretty wild before that. My dad was 16 and my mom was 16 when they got married because they had to. And that was back in the day when she got pregnant, you got married. I'm doing it. My dad was a cowboy, and my mom was a dairyman's daughter, and they got married, okay? They never understood, and they began pursuit of God. And my dad was a man that was in pursuit of God his life. My dad died when he was 46 of cancer, of skin cancer. But my dad was a man that probably the man I respected most in life for a lot of reasons. And one of them was that he was in pursuit of God. But they never dealt with that, the guilt and the shame. Okay? And as a result, they didn't deal with us as kids. And as a result, none of his kids were virgins when we got married. Right? Because of their guilt and shame that kept them from speaking truth of God. Because who are you to say something? It's something that kept me silent for far too many years. And the enemy beat me up with, you can't go teach up there sitting in. You know, who are you to say anything about this? I'm not. But the truth of God is the truth of God. And guilt and shame no longer are what determine me. The truth of God determines me. And the glory of the gospel is that I have been set free from guilt and shame. Does it trash my kids? Yeah, on some level, all of them. Still does. Still dealing with effects of my rebellion, of my sinful nature. My parents were unwilling to talk about that because they felt so guilty. You know, and you go, well, and truthfully, as a result of that, you know how I looked at it? My parents had a great relationship. My parents were best friends. My parents, at 15 and 16, had sex outside of marriage and had a baby. Man, that fit perfect with my 60s love child mentality, right? And I looked at it and said, if I could have a relationship as good as my parents, I'm good with that. And they had sex outside of marriage. And they, look at him. And they're, if I could just have a relationship that good, my parents were good friends. My parents were best friends, okay? That's the grace of God. I know that. I know it was the mercy of grace. But I looked at it as a child trying to figure out what it looked like, and all there was rules and regulations. The church says you can't, but it really sucks. And I don't really want to be, you know, like you fat boys walking around church anyway. Right? Right? I mean, but that looks like fun over there, so... If you can't be, then it's just about being in love, right? My parents didn't deal with it, guilt and shame. Okay? And as a result, trashed my siblings and me. As a result, trashed all my siblings' children in doing it and pounded them for the most part, okay, with it. Because it wasn't dealt with. Okay? Why? Because of guilt and shame. Let me tell you, men and women, because it haunts you women too. Deal with guilt and shame. It can be dealt with. Very great. That's the truth of the gospel. Jesus died to set us free. And you can be set free from the guilt and shame that controls you. The effects of sin are the effects of sin, man. You crash in your car and become paralyzed. You know. And I will go through life on some level paralyzed, but I can be set free from the paralyzation of guilt and shame. Okay? And it's essential. Because the enemy will use it to go, who are you to say something? Who are you to to talk about purity? Who are you to talk about holiness? You know? And rightfully so. You know, my oldest son probably says that. You know? Probably still says that. Who are you to say that? And I don't, it's not that I preach at him or beat him up or hit him over the head with his Bible, you know, too often. But I'm sure that he looks at that and says, who are you to say no? Who are you to say don't do that? The enemy will use that line. I'm confident he used it in David. The biggest tragedy of this story, David did nothing. He was silent. What should he have done? He should have dealt with Ammon. Right? I don't know about Tamar. I don't know about the crying out in the city part. I don't know exactly what happens. It seems to me she said, no, don't. Don't do this. Don't act like this. Right? There was a lot of reasons, but Ammon did not respond to it. He was consumed in his lust. It shows the tragedy of being determined and consumed by that, of being so in love, right? He immediately hated her. His guilt and shame caused him to hate her and kick her out in the street. That does happen. The wages of sin is death, hatred. And he hated her as a result of that and kicked her out on the street, treated her terribly. Absalom, I'm not sure that he acted wrongly. He did what his father should have done. I mean, that's a big deal. David had a problem. Often we see David could not deal in a disciplinary, severe way with his own family. He didn't deal with Joab, right? I mean, Joab killed Abner, who was a virtuous man who came and do it, and he shouldn't have, and he let it go. David seemed to let... That was a weakness that he had, which I will say is another thing. Those who God has put in our charge and the most closest to us should be the ones that are most dealt with. There is to be no double standard. And if there is a standard of truth and righteousness, it should be within our own homes, in our own family. And I'll go beyond that, within the men in the church body. But it isn't about us judging those outside. How could they're pagans? They don't know God. What can you expect of them? But if you claim to know God, then the standard is set by God in doing it. And if we love each other, we don't overlook sin. Because it means your wives are trash and your kids are trash and the people around you are trash doing that. David was unwilling somehow to deal with his family and his close family. He didn't deal with Ammon. So the stuff started happening bad and ugly. Absalom, his beloved Absalom. He loved Absalom. It seems pretty obvious that he had this tremendous affection towards Absalom, at least. He was struggled. It says that, you know, in the last verse, it's pretty telling. He says, so Absalom fled, gone to Geshur, and there was 3 years. And the heart of King David longed to go out to Absalom. For he was comforted concerning Ammon, since he was dead. Comforted, you mean he was over the fact that he hadn't dealt with it and hadn't done anything about it. What do you think? How did Tamar feel? I mean, we don't know if she was... The word means... That doesn't necessarily mean that she never married or never was married. I don't know. But not being a virgin in that day, continue to read in Deuteronomy just prior to that. Okay? It says if a woman is shown not to be a virgin after you get married, you take her to her father's doorstep and stone her. Again, you say, oh, how archaic, how, what would you call it? How Taliban-ish, you know? How Sharia-law-ish? How, the Bible says, and it isn't a matter of beating someone up in guilt, because all of us in this room, on some level, living in this culture, I suspect have to go, oh, crap, man. Right? God, Jesus died for that. We can be forgiven and we can know forgiveness and we can be empowered to not be in bondage to sin in doing that. That's what God calls us to. We can be set free, but God calls us to be set free. Not to be controlled by it, not to be consumed by it so that we trash our children and our guilt and shame, but to be set free from it. David wasn't, and as a result, his family got beat. And the legacy of being a man after God's own heart was shattered and trashed and beat up. Is that what we want? We can do it God's way and see it prosper, or we can do it the enemy's way. Watch the next generation get trashed. There's a pretty strong, I hear it, I've heard it, and it's a common understanding. Oh, kids are just going to be what kids are going to be, right? Kids are just going to turn out the way kids are going to turn out. We can't really do anything about that. That is life in the pit of hell. We are absolutely responsible for the souls of our children, and we'll be accountable, and we'll be answerable for it. Does that mean we can determine them? No. God gave every man the choice of who they will serve, and woman, if they will serve the true and living God, or they will not serve the true and living God. But their perception of God, as we stated, their perception of God is based in their perception of the Father. And the mother, father and mother are one flesh, and to be one flesh. And if their perception of their father is like David, who did not respond in defense of Tamar, who did not respond in was unwilling to deal with Ammon in his sin, no matter how hard it was. He knew what he should have done. He knew the law. He knew God's heart in that. But look what he'd done. You know, he'd hidden his sin with Bathsheba for a long time. Right? Why? What should have happened to David? He should have been stoned. Right? He should have been stoned. He didn't want to. Well, I don't want to set a bad example. Well, I don't want the people to, you know, so let me hide it, right? Let me hide it. Because if they really see this in me, then maybe they'll stumble and, you know, they won't know what to do. So I should hide my sin, you know, right? Isn't that what we do? It's a pretty common practice among church leaders. Okay? I mean, just wait, just hold a little distance, you know, here doing it. Because if they find that, they might struggle in their relationship with God. His sons looked at David and said, Father, God the Father, is that how he acts? He doesn't act in righteousness. He doesn't act in truth. He acts with favoritism. He acts based on how much hurt it would cause him or pain it would cause him. He's not the defender of the innocent. For all intent and purposes, I want to suspect Tamar was innocent. I don't know, you know, for sure. But it seems like it. God was pretty clear to give her speeches about why not to do this and how to deal with it correctly if it is. And we are both virgins, and my father will not withhold you from me if you went to him. Because culturally, David could have given her to be his wife. Don't kick me out. Don't act like this. Don't, you know. But David didn't act in a responsible way. I cannot, if any of us have guilt and shame, if sin that is undealt with, the effect that it will have on your children and your wife and the people around you is profound. It is not just your hidden sin. It will trash the people around you. Deal with it. That's the truth of the gospel. And if you don't believe that, then you don't believe the gospel. That's why Jesus had to die in our place. It's why he did die in our place. It's why he gave us a way of escape. And it's why he has set everything in place for us to live an empowered life. To be free from the corruption that is in this world by lust. Amen? Let's pray. God, there's so much in it. I don't know why I just struggled with wanting to talk about this. What a mess. I mean, you don't talk about this. Strangers might come into church and go, what kind of Bible do you read? What kind of God do you serve? What a mess. But the truth is, it's why Jesus needed to do what Jesus did. It's why you needed to do what you did to give us a way to be right with you, our God. To redeem your creation to yourself. And that is your purpose, redemption. That is your purpose for every one of us in this room, is redemption. That you want to redeem us to yourself. So that we don't continue. What does he say? To put them to death so that they stop the sin in the camp. So it is dealt with so that it doesn't continue to go generation. The sins of a father continue for seven generations because it's not dealt with. God, I ask that you would cause us to love each other enough to fight alongside each other in our marriages, to fight alongside the single people here that are getting bombarded and pounded relentlessly, that need to learn and reconform to what your idea of sexual purity is, that have already turned the faucet on but need to learn it's okay to turn it off and it can go dry and be okay. That we should know the effort that it causes in our marriages, that we should live pure between our wives and us. Have no one else there. We're one flesh, just like you represented that to be our relationship with you. No other gods before you. Holy and sacred, nothing between us. No sin. Holiness between us. You and us and you, God. And that's what it's to look like with our wives. I thank you that you give us an example of how wrong it can go if we don't do it your way. How bad it can look and how wrong it can go. God, I ask you to not let none of us as men separate ourselves so far from this wretched Ammon and realize that we are deserving of death also. It's only by your grace and your mercy and your patience and your compassion that we can be set free from that, that we are not to be put to death, pay for our sin, do no good in redeeming us. It's only what we're due. I thank you. You died in our place, Jesus. I thank you that you gave us a way of escape. God, please cause us to go out and be concerned about renewing our view of holiness. Be concerned about the corruption that is in this world by lust, because it's a big deal that affects us all. And you call us to be separate from that. You call us to be outside of that. God, please cause us to be willing to give up that adrenaline rush, that drug, that addiction that we all put ourselves under as children, probably for the most part here, and wanting and longing for that rush of immorality. Cause us to realize that that is not how you created it to be and you intended it to be. Please block out David from these, block out this David from these brothers and sisters and friends' minds. And God, please let your voice be heard. Let your voice be heard. Let your spirit move hearts this week, that we would ponder and consider your truth and your words. Amen.